We're doing the Seder HaKabbalah. We had seen last time that the first generation of Tanaim was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The second generation were his disciples, Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Yossi HaKoin, Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, Shimon ben Zoma, Rabbi Lezer Chisma, Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, Shmuel HaKotan, Rabbi Lezer ben Azaria, Unkulos. And then the third generation is what we're up to. The third generation of Tanaim is Rabbi Akiva. He was a disciple of Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yoshua. Shaya Rosh Yeshiva. He was also the head of the academy. Achal Ador HaShini. After that second generation. V'Rabbi Tarfon, V'Rabbi Ishmael, V'Rabbi Meir, Shekibel Tchilam Rabbi Eliezer, V'Acharav Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Ishmael. They were two contemporaries, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael. And they argued on very basic points. Like, do you say Ribui Miut Ribui? Or Klalu Pratu Klal? Basic arguments between Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Meir initially learned by Rabbi Eliezer, who was also Rabbi Akiva's Rabbi. And then he learned by Rabbi Akiva. And then he learned by Rabbi Ishmael. Now this third generation also had Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, Rabbi Yehuda Anachtom, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Nechemiah, Rabbi Natan, Rabbi Yochanan Asandlar, Rabbi Lezer ben Shamua, Rabbi Shimon ben Azai. Not to be confused with Shimon ben Zoma, who was a generation earlier. When we encounter Ben Azai in the Mishnah, that's Shimon ben Azai. Rabbi Chutzpita Tugiman, the translator. Elisha ben Avuya, you guys remember him. So he's the same generation as Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir learned from him, but he's still the same generation. That's Acher. Rabbi Yehuda ben Dama, Rabbi Hanania ben Tradion, Rabbi Sheva Vasofer. These two were among the 10 martyrs. Rabbi Simai, uvimeim haya Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira beBavel. In their day, you had Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, not to be confused with the earlier Bnei Beteira of the generation before Hillel and Shammai. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira was in this third generation in Bavel. These are the generations of Tanaim after the destruction of the Temple. Remember, prior to the destruction, you had four generations going back to Hillel. Hillel, Shimon, Gamliel, Shimon. That was the hundred years before the destruction of the temple. Now we're talking about the generations after the temple. In this generation, you had the king Bathalmu, which was also what we call him Talmai. Amad ben Kuziva. In this generation of Rabbi Akiva, we had the leader named Ben Kuziva. V'asatzmo Mashiach. He declared himself the Messiah. The Talmud says that he had a huge following. The Torah b'macharav. Many followed him in error. Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva too, believed initially that Ben Kuziva would be the Mashiach. He was his weapons carrier. The Talmud tells us in the Jerusalem Talmud in Tanis that when he'd see Bar Kochva, he'd say, that's the Mashiach. And the Rambam says, in Hilchos Melachim, the Rambam says that Rabbi Akiva erred, thinking that Bar Kochva was the Mashiach. Oh, v'shalach bar kuziva ze yado b'melech Romi shaya shmo Damstian. The Domitian was the Roman king against whom Bar Kochva rebelled. V'araget mishneu, he killed his vice president, he killed his governor. U'malach beveitar shnat nun bet lachurban habayit v'yamot. He ruled. He set up his throne in Beitar. That was the capital of Bar Kochva's rule. And his rule was the 52nd year after the destruction of the temple. Umalach bno achrav echen ben bno, and his son took the throne, and then his grandson. Ad shala Adrianus kesar shnatayim gimel achurban. So he attributes to Bar Kochva a natural death, and to his son, and then his grandson was king. All of 21 years later, Adrian the Caesar came back, v'arag ben benosha ben kuziva, and he killed Bar Kochva's grandson. Yeah, guys? New Jewish history.
Bar Kochva's grandson, weren't they totally wiped out?
There's in the footnotes here they discuss different things, but I don't know where he got this from. I don't know.
So he's saying that Rav Kochva lived out his life peacefully?
That's what he seems to say. He said he doesn't indicate that he was murdered. He says Bar Kocha died, his son was king after him, and then his grandson. And then Adrianus Kesan came with his army and killed his grandson. That's what he says.
The normal is that Adrianus killed Bar Kocha or someone else killed Bar Kocha?
In the war, yeah.
Is Adrianus?
Look, it's a little bit hard to understand how in 21 years Bar Kocha died and his son died. What happened? He doesn't tell us.
But where was the kingdom? Because I was taught, for instance, I mean, the bodies, for instance, were just left there in the streets.
Right. After they killed them, they were so upset at them, they wouldn't let them bury them for a long time. After the Romans killed out Bar Kocha. Right, that's true. That's a different point.
Where was the kingdom?
Beitar.
In Beitar is where the bodies were, no?
Yeah.
So that, like another area?
No. Beitar was where... that was his capital. And according to the Meiri, it lasted for 21 years until the Romans came and defeated him. Now, we have on tradition that when the Romans defeated the people of Beitar, they were so upset at them that they forced us to leave the bodies and let them rot. And their blood fertilized the vineyards all around there. Their blood would you'd literally have streams of blood going to the vineyards all around there. And they didn't need to use fertilizer for years later. And then finally, when they let us bury them, so then there was a miracle that the bodies hadn't rotted. They had intended to teach a lesson, to extend their vengeance to the bodies of the deceased. And God made it that the bodies did not rot.
In Beitar.
Good guys or bad guys?
Who are good guys or bad guys?
Good guys in Beitar.
It's a good question. At least initially, Rabbi Akiva thought they were good guys. Rabbi Akiva saw his error. Rabbi Akiva lived 120 years. He lived to see that this wasn't right. In this generation, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion was murdered by the Romans, and Rabbi Yeshevav, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, and Rabbi Chutzpit Tatugaman, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, and Rabbi Akiva, Mibnei Kas ben Kuziva. He tells us a secret. He says, you know why they took our great rabbis and cruelly tortured them to death? Because they were upset at what had happened with Bar Kochva's rebellion. Now we get the full story. Ordinarily, you hear how they... You have the whole Medrash, which we say in Yom Kippur and in Tisha B'Av, about how they came with this ploy, and they said, you know, no one ever paid up for the sale of Yosef. You ten are going to be instead. He tells us, no, it was all out of anger for Bar Kokhba's rebellion, and we could also understand it, because if Rabbi Akiva joined forces with Bar Kokhba, so then... He was the spiritual force behind the rebellion. Rabbi Yehuda ben Dama, Rabbi Yehuda Nachtom, these two rabbis were also murdered by the Romans. Now, it's very interesting that he writes this. There was a rabbi who lived about 30, 40 years ago. He lived before and after the Holocaust. His name was Rav Henkin. And Rav Henkin, he was very, very busy after the war, helping the Talmidei Chachamim get... find Parnasa, support themselves. Remember, when Jews came from the Holocaust, it was very hard to reestablish themselves. So he headed an organization called Ezra's Torah, which helped Jews in Israel and in America reestablish themselves financially. So because he was so busy helping people, he didn't write that many big works. He wrote many short works. And in one of his works, he discusses that when we say Rabbi Akiva's students all died between Pesach and Lag BaOmer, so the rabbis were hiding an important piece of history. They were hiding the fact that they were all murdered in wars against the Romans. That it was because Rabbi Akiva joined forces with Bar Kochva that all these students were killed. That 24,000 students were killed in such a short period of time. And then he goes one step further, and he says that famous argument about Tanuro Shel Achnai, that earthenware oven where the rabbis discussed, if you cut it into three portions, and then ordinarily an oven is tamei. You break it in two, so the bigger half can still be used. If you think of an oven like, a big barrel. So if you cut the barrel in two, you could still use the bigger half of the barrel as an oven. But if you take the bigger half and cut that in two, So then you no longer have a big piece that's worthy of being used as a zamnin. It's no longer tamei. What happens if you put tar all around and you fix it up and then use it again? So then it's tamei again. What happens if you put sand in between and tar above the sand? So you're not really putting the puzzle back together again. You're putting like three donuts, one on top of the other, with sand in between, and then you're putting tar above it. So that was what's called tanuro shel achnai, the oven that's like a snake, because a snake coils itself up in such a circular form, a spiral. And so such an oven came before Rabbi Eliezer and the sages, and they asked them, is that oven, does it get back its tumah or not? Do we consider it like you fixed it again or no? So Rabbi Eliezer said it's tahor, and all the rabbis said it's tameh. And Rabbi Eliezer started arguing vehemently. He said, if I'm right, the stream will start flowing backwards. The stream starts flowing backwards. If I'm right, the tree will pick itself up and go 50 feet away. It went 50 feet away. If I'm right, the walls of the academy will start caving in. The walls of the academy start caving in. Heavenly voice comes out and says, what are you arguing with him for? He's right. It's tahor. The rabbi, Rabbi Gamliel, gets on his feet and says, you told us, God, that the Torah is in our hands, and we have to do the way we understand. And out of honor for you, it's not our own honor, we have to do the way we understand. The way we understand is it is tameh. And they declared it tameh, and they ostracized Rabbi Eliezer, and they defiled everything that he declared was tahor with that oven. Okay, you read the story on the surface, seems like a fantastic story. Says Rav Henkin, the story is not about an oven. Why are they calling the oven of the serpent? They had no better name. So he says the serpent is a reference to the Roman Empire. And the questions that the rabbis were dealing with, they encoded in such a fantastic story. But really, they were scared for their lives. So they couldn't give away the real story they were discussing, which was, how patriotic should we be to the Roman Empire that has taken over Israel? All the rabbis said, they're tameh, they're defiled, you can't have anything to do with them. We have to join Bar Kokhba, we have to fight them, we have to fight to the end. And Rav Lezer said, no, they're tahor, they're fine. God sent them to conquer us, but if we make peace with them, Torah can thrive. And they couldn't divulge that this is what they were arguing about. Ultimately, Rav Lezer was proven right. But they held that he was a danger. You can't have a situation where all the rabbis decide we're fighting a war, and one rabbi says, no, we're not, we should make peace. Well, then you're a traitor. So they said, now you're out of the picture of Eliezer. You're not going to stand there and contradict everything we're doing. You're outnumbered. This is our vote. And if you're going to try to prove us by all kinds of godly feats that you're right, well, that's not going to work. We're not going to do it. We've decided this is the way to go. This is the way we're going. And they went that route and lost 24,000 students in error. Ultimately, we say, Rabbi Eliezer was probably right. But the historical price was paid. So it's very interesting that the way he's portraying the picture, the whole murder of all these great rabbis was really a reaction to the rebellion against Bar Kokhba. Once we put two and two together, we put this together with the story, with Rav Henkin's interpretation, that the rabbis really were a very significant part of the rebellion. They played a very strong role. They sent their students out there to fight the Romans. Well, then we understand the Roman response. So this is just an interesting, you know, you put this together with that, and it's an interesting point.
Well, how did Rav Henkin get that?
That's an excellent question. So I went to Rav Pesin Zatzal once, okay. And I said, you know, Rav Henkin has a few works where he puts all kinds of genius thoughts into the Gemara, and where to get it from? So I have to give you a little bit of backdrop to the answer to this question. When Rav Pesin Zatzal went to be tested for a smicha by Rav Henkin, in order to enter the test, Rav Henkin would ask him a question, and he would have to answer him which siman in Shulchan Aruch the answer could be found. Meaning, you know, the whole Shulchan Aruch, the whole codex? He'd ask a question, he'd have to answer him which siman. Okay, now we're doing Aruch Chaim. Okay, I'll ask you a question. Echos Pesach, tell me which chapter. You understand what that means? He has to remember every siman by heart. That was to enter the test. That wasn't the test. That was to enter the test. That was the test before the test. That was to get accepted to the test. So you have to understand what kind of genius Rav Henkin was. So he said to me that a genius like Rav Henkin, when you're a genius like Rav Henkin, then you could do that. Whatever that answer means. Rav Kook also has a line like that in the introduction to his work, Midbar Shur, where he says that after learning for years, a person reaches a point where he can understand themes of the Torah, and it's not only about saying, okay, this indicates this and that indicates that. It's more of a picture which you can get from the Torah in a more general way. It's a similar thought. It's not identical. But more than that, I don't know. You see, when I learned this piece by Rav Henkin, I was also bothered. Wait a second, where'd you get that from? Okay.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I mean, I can imagine.